Genealogy by Tim, Season 2, Episode 11, recorded November 26, 2022. I had quite the busy month this month. Not making family history discoveries, but working on the server that hosts my website and family tree. The goal of all this work? To get a functional email server up and running so that I can send and receive emails from the genealogybytim.com domain. The work was half successful. I can explain, but how about a little context first? I'm talking all about my server today and my most recent effort to become my own email service. That's coming your way on Genealogy by Tim. It was about 10 years ago that I first established an online presence for my genealogical endeavors. At the time, I was developing a side hustle as a digital photo restorer, and like any good business does, I needed a website. I went with a WordPress site because I had experience blogging personally with WordPress, but there were many options available to accomplish roughly the same task. But you don't need to be running a small business to want to set up your own website. Anyone can have one. The best feature of personal websites is the people they attract. Some call it cousin bait. You can set out the bait online and let the cousins come to you. One easy way to get your information online is to utilize websites that others have established for public use. Some examples of this include the FamilySearch Family Tree, Ancestry.com public and private member trees, and sites like WikiTree and WeRelate. Among the benefits of using sites like this is that there's virtually no setup. These sites come ready to use, and those with average computer skills can figure out how to get in and get started putting their family history information out there. Many of these sites are also either free or low cost. Among the limitations of sites like these is that you don't really control the experience. Webmasters of these sites basically decide how things are laid out, when the layout changes. Many of these sites are kind of like walled gardens where only other website members can find your information. So, the reach of many of these sites is limited. Lastly, you're not really in control of your data with these sites. You know, the big sites like Ancestry.com and FamilySearch.org are relatively stable, but other sites come and go. When they go, they can take your data with them. In one notable example from 2015, many users of the Ancestry brand MyFamily.com lost years of correspondence and family history when Ancestry shuttered the brand. For a little bit more of a personal touch, family historians looking to publish their work online might consider blogging platforms. Some names that come to mind are WordPress, Blogger, LiveJournal, and Tumblr. These platforms all offer a long-form blogging platform and the ability to embed media like photos, audio, video, YouTube videos, and the like. Many of these platforms also offer a variety of theming options, so you can really add that personal design touch. The free versions of these blogging platforms will give you a subdomain with their free plan, and offer an option to buy your own domain upon upgrade to a paid plan. For example, when I started my Photo Restorations by Tim G blog at WordPress, the original URL was restorationsbytim.wordpress.com. When I upgraded to a paid plan, I was able to purchase the domain restorationsbytim.com without the WordPress in the middle. And I was able to customize the site to my liking with an antique-looking theme. When you have that theme that you like, and when you have your own domain, you really get that feeling like, hey, this is my website. But you don't have to stop there. Blog sites like WordPress are really great, but they lack the kind of specialized family history tools that you'll find on sites like Ancestry.com and FamilySearch.org. This is when you consider going to the next level and buying some web hosting services. Web hosting is kind of like a blank slate. It's the digital equivalent of unimproved land. Basically, you purchase from a web hosting provider a certain amount of storage space, a certain amount of bandwidth, and certain basic elements of software that make a website run at its most basic levels. Then you just build your site on top of that. Popular web hosting providers include Bluehost, GoDaddy, HostGator, Amazon Web Services, and since I'm a Linux nerd, I've got to put a plug in for Linode. On the simpler end of these, Bluehost, GoDaddy, and HostGator offer shared web hosting with a manager like cPanel. You have little access to the host computer other than to drop the files you need where you want them and then to launch the site. On the more complex end, services like Amazon Web Services and Linode are full cloud computing platforms, and they basically offer you your own little online virtual computer where you get to install your own operating system with root access and build everything you need on top of that, basically without limits. For the types of things I do, simple shared web hosting should suffice. Once you have your host, you could start coding a website from scratch, but for the masses of us who aren't coders, there are plenty of pre-made software packages to install, set up, and launch. A very popular option is to actually install the WordPress blogging software onto your host. This creates a blog with all the functionality of a paid WordPress.com account, but it frees the user from the policies and pricing of WordPress.com. It also offers the user greater freedom to tweak the code and add custom plugins to extend functionality further. There are WordPress plugins like WPTree and TreePress that can help you to build a family tree on a WordPress site. I haven't personally tried any of these, but you know, I may test them out in the near future and report back with what I find. But it doesn't stop there. There's a whole world of different web apps available depending on the user's needs. When I was still running my photo restoration side hustle, I used the web-based Odoo business software to keep track of customer orders and business finances. Later, when I launched a Genealogy by Tim G website, I used Drupal to manage my content, although I could have easily used the Joomla software for the same purpose. If I ever decide to open an online store, software like OpenCart is available for that purpose. So when you purchase web hosting, only your imagination limits what you can do with that space. And for us genealogists, some software that you might look into to hosting your own family tree is, well, first of all, WebTrees. That's what I use to host my family tree. But there are similar software packages like, for example, GeneWeb, Humo Genealogy, and a popular one that I've seen around the web in many places is TNG, the next generation of genealogy site building. I'll link to each of these software packages in the show notes. Besides purchasing your own web hosting, there is another option for getting a website up and running, and that is self-hosting. Genealogy by Tim G is a fully self-hosted website, and what that means is I do not pay a third party to host my content and serve it to the web. I have a computer in my apartment that runs nearly 24/7, serving data to the web for all to see. Although this is the most cost-effective option, I don't believe it's right for everyone. For one thing, setting it all up takes a fair amount of technical know-how. Things don't get set up in one click the way they do on paid hosts. I wrote a series of posts for my restoration site as I was setting up this server in 2020. Each of those posts explains what I had to do to set the server up. They aren't exactly light reading. There's a lot there. For another thing, I've experienced a lot of downtime on my server. When you pay for web hosting, you pay experts whose full-time job is to maintain their systems and keep them online. I have a day job. I'm not always around to pick up my system when it falls. I've messed around with power cables the day before a week-long trip, only to discover that I've knocked something loose and put my site offline for a week. Sometimes my system runs hot and doesn't restart when I issue the restart command, so my site will be offline until the machine cools down and it's able to restart. Sometimes an update will go awry and I'll have trouble rebooting the server. I've since set up a backup server to guard against this particular problem, but you get the idea. When you run your own server and you aren't constantly there to monitor it, the downtime is real. I don't know how many times I've had to call my girlfriend from wherever I am to ask her if she can restart my server because the site's down. These are some of the cons, you know, why you might not want to run your own server, but what are some of the pros? Why self-host? Well, for me, it's basically free. You really don't need a fancy machine with flashing lights and whirring fans to run a web server. Just about any old computer will do. You can run a web server on a $40 Raspberry Pi single board computer if you want. If you upgrade your laptop to a newer model, don't throw away your old laptop. It can be your new web server. I've taken this philosophy to a bit of an extreme to prove a point. The machine I'm using as a web server is a 2005 Compaq NC6230 business laptop computer. When it was new, it was quite a powerhouse. I bought the machine used on eBay in about 2015. What had happened was, about that time, in addition to doing photo restorations, I made some money on the side by doing some computer tutoring and consulting. So I bought these laptops with the intent of making them learner computers that clients could use or even borrow to practice on. They came in a pair and they cost $40 for the pair. After I received the first two, I received the second pair in the mail without ordering them, so I wrote back to the seller and I said, "Hey, I just received the second box with two more computers, but I didn't order them. I wouldn't mind having them. How do you want to handle this?" He wrote back to me and said, "I appreciate your honesty. You can keep the computers." So now I own four of these laptops, and one of them was my main machine for a couple years until I treated myself to a powerhouse desktop in 2016. Since then, these laptops have just been collecting dusts in various closets until the pandemic of 2020, when I thought to myself, you know, I bet they would be better web servers than my Raspberry Pi. So I went ahead and did what I described in the last of my Restorations by Tim.com blog posts, and the rest is history. If you would like to use an old computer to set up a web server, I would recommend using a computer made after 2010 or so. These are more likely to be 64-bit machines, and most modern server software runs only on 64-bit machines. For example, Ubuntu Server and Fedora Server are available only in 32-bit versions. Other server operating systems like Debian and Gentoo are still available in 32-bit versions, but they could drop support at any time, so it's best to hop on the 64-bit machines as soon as that's convenient. Another problem with the 32-bit machines is that they're subject to the year 2038 problem. My Drupal installation actually does not accept dates prior to the year 1901 and after the year 2038. The site actually throws a fatal error if I try to enter one, which is, you know, kind of troublesome for genealogists who must frequently handle dates prior to 1901. So, just because you can use a 17-year-old 32-bit machine to host your genealogy website, it doesn't mean you should. I would definitely recommend using a 64-bit machine. Yes, some very old, very cheap machines can be web servers. Of course, if you get too many users coming to the site at once, or if your site loads a lot of high-resource media like videos, the server won't be able to handle all the traffic, and it will run into performance issues. I don't believe I've experienced this problem yet. If my site's up, it's usually pretty responsive, and the homepage on the Gramanflick family tree has over 11,000 hits as of this recording, so the site is seeing some traffic. I can only hope that those hits are from people, not bots, although it's a little hard to tell sometimes. Despite its difficulties, there is one area where self-hosting wins hands down over many paid third-party hosting options, and that's data storage. If you take a look at the pricing on GoDaddy.com, even their maximum tier plan, which is priced at $19.99 a month for the first three-year terms and $24.99 a month thereafter, is limited to 100 gigabytes of data. Even my humble 17-year-old laptop has more storage than that. For each of my servers, I went on eBay and purchased 320 gigabyte IDE hard drives for like $40 each. Each of these things pretty much pays for itself within 2 months and gives me triple the data storage that GoDaddy offers. And in addition to that, I could plug in external storage that could boost my storage up to 1 terabyte, 2 terabytes. There's really no limit. Now, I wouldn't even have been able to use GoDaddy's lowest tier, that's economy tier. That one costs $4.99 a month for the first 3-year term and $8.99 a month thereafter, and it offers only 25 gigabytes of storage. I know I have more data than that. Now, there are hosting services out there that offer unlimited storage, so it pays to shop around a little. MochaHost, that's MochaHost, is one such hosting provider. They were recently recognized by Forbes Advisor as the best overall hosting platform. Forbes wrote in its review that, based on its inclusion of unlimited storage and bandwidth, MochaHost is ideal for those who are building content-heavy sites, such as sites that display a portfolio, an e-commerce site with a large product catalog, or any site with a high volume of website visitors. That would include us genealogists, with our countless photographs and high-quality document scans. Just make sure you clear the rights to post all of those documents before you do. So, how much did and do I spend to run my servers? Well, I run 2 machines, a main server and a backup. The machines themselves cost me $10 each back in 2014. The 320 gigabyte hard drives cost me $40 each. The power cables were about $12 each. That's about $124 total in hardware costs. Yearly, I pay Bluehost $20 for the genealogybytim.com domain name, and I've had the domain for 2 years. Now I'm up to about $164. If I'd gone, say, with GoDaddy's deluxe hosting, I would have already spent over $200, and I'd still be paying $7.99 a month, and even that would increase after the initial term runs out. MochaHost's business plan is about half the price, but even they can't beat the $20 a year for self-hosting plus registered domain name. One last cost consideration to make when self-hosting is power consumption. Running a pair of computers 24/7 can significantly add to one's energy bill. I haven't run all the numbers, but these costs will tend to be on the low end for those running laptops as servers like I do, and they'll increase as the servers become more powerful. Needless to say, the cost is manageable in my case. Pico, my local energy company, typically reports that my apartment's power consumption is pretty much on par with that of my neighbors. I do have aspirations, however, of upgrading to some actual server machines if and when I ever move out of my apartment and into a house. There's just no place for machines like that here in my apartment. They're too big, the fans are too loud, and there's no escaping them. When I eventually move into a house, there's going to be like a tech man cave with lots of whirring fans and flashing lights, probably down in the basement somewhere. And that brings me to the work that I managed to accomplish on my machines over the past month, and that is, I actually managed to get an email server up and running. This again is another service that could be more easily provided by web hosts, but I'm interested to see what I can do on my own. Now, I attempted this about a year ago and got pretty much nowhere. One thing you gotta learn when you're an aspiring tech geek is that some problems you just got to walk away from for a little bit. Let time pass, clear your mind, give it another shot in the future. Last month I gave the old email server another shot, and I got much further than I did before. I'm not sure why. Maybe the tutorial that I followed has been updated, who knows, but I did manage to get something up and running. The tutorial that I followed is the Gentoo Complete Virtual Mail Server tutorial. I'll link to it in the show notes. That tutorial recommends installing PostFix for the SMTP server, Dovecot for the IMAP server, Postgres SQL for the database, PostFix admin for the email administration, and database setup, and Roundcube for the webmail client. Each of these elements has its own arcane configuration files to go through. It really is the most complex thing I've ever attempted to do on a computer to date. It makes setting up the Apache web server that runs my website look like flipping on a light switch. To make matters even more complicated, residential internet service like mine is not really set up to do the things I'm doing. First of all, and this affects all aspects of the website, the residential internet service does not provide a static IP address to my apartment. This means that initially, viewers coming to my website from the outside do not have a reliable, consistent address to return to. My domain name does not have a reliable address to point to. That address is subject to change at the whim of the internet service provider. So I have to use a third-party service to provide that reliable address. In my case, that's noip.com. It's a free service, but they try to make the service a little annoying to get you to purchase their product. Once a month, I have to log into noip.com and confirm that I'm still using the service. What happens is that NoIP provides a piece of software that regularly reads my current IP address and reports it back to noip.com. Then, NoIP has an address for me that's always pointing to whatever address my machine reports. So, my web server's static IP address is 68.83.239.235. That's the address provided by noip.com, and those who visit that address will get forwarded to whatever my web server's IP address happens to be at that time. So that's one thing. Another thing that my residential internet service provider does is that it blocks certain router ports that an email server is likely to use, notably port 25. It does this because spammers out there in the world can actually commandeer running web servers and use them as relays to forward spam. This is where, if you're not careful, you can kind of mess things up for others and cause more spam to be out there in the world. Residential internet service prevents this by blocking ports through which spammers are likely to relay spam mail. These happen to be the same ports through which I would like to send legitimate emails. So the workaround for this was to set up an SMTP relay through the email provider sendinblue.com. I had to follow a little tutorial to get that done, and I'll link to that in the show notes. Sendinblue.com accepts mail from a port that I'm allowed to use on my residential internet service and forwards those messages on my behalf. Sendinblue has a free tier that allows me to send up to 300 emails per day. It also throttles emails at various rates, beginning at 40 emails per hour. This protects my brand reputation in case spammers get into my system and start forwarding spam. If spammers freely send mail from my server, my domain and IP address can end up on various naughty lists that email providers like Gmail use to filter spam into spam folders. I sure don't want to end up there. The right way, of course, to set up these things, website, email server, and all, is simply to purchase business class internet from my internet service provider. This would provide a static IP address and open the ports that I need to conduct the business of running a proper website. It would remove the need for middlemen like NoIP and Sendinblue. It would also incur additional costs that might tip the scales in favor of moving my website and email service to paid hosting like GoDaddy or MochaHost. It's not a decision I intend to make anytime soon, though. First, let me get a house. And in that house, let me get me a set of business class server machines, and maybe then I'll look into subscribing to some business class internet service. So this month I set up the software, the PostFix, the Dovecot, the Postgres SQL, the Roundcube, all that good stuff. I set up the workarounds that I need because I'm too cheap to buy business class internet service, and I launched an email server. I still have one problem left to solve. The server currently only sends email. It cannot yet receive email. let's focus on the positive first. My server can send emails. That's great because my website supports a number of automatic email functions that have up until now been non-functional. First, my WebTrees installation at webtrees.genealogybytim.com is supposed to send confirmation emails to visitors who attempt to create user accounts. It even says on that sign-up page, go ahead and check your email for a confirmation. But then it would not send a confirmation email. The site now does actually send that email, and potential members can use that email to confirm their email addresses. Another feature that has been enabled is that both my landing page at genealogybytim.com and my WebTrees installation now send emails to my personal address whenever anyone attempts to create a new member account. This is great because it will speed up turnaround time for approving or rejecting new requests. Funny enough, as soon as I turned on my email service, my personal email received a flood of backlogged emails for pending spam account requests, so now I'm looking into some kind of CAPTCHA to limit those requests. You might think CAPTCHAs are annoying, but now being on the receiving end of spam account requests, their value to society is pretty clear to me. Lastly, I can technically hop onto my webmail at webmail.genealogybytim.com, compose an email, and send it. I can do that. Practically, however, it is not very useful because my email server cannot yet receive emails. Replies to emails that I send will get bounced, and I can't yet advertise using the tim@genealogybytim.com email address on my site for the same reason. Although it would be fantastic to correspond with website visitors using email from the genealogybytim.com domain, I can't really do that yet. If you send an email to that address, it gets returned with a server has denied access error message. So I'll be troubleshooting that over the next several weeks at least. And I still haven't even gotten all the way through the Gentoo virtual mail server tutorial. I've still got DKIM signatures to set up, Spam Assassin to filter spam, ClamAV to scan for viruses, so I've got a lot of work ahead of me. But it's amazing to see some automatic email functions of my site up and running. And hopefully one day soon I'll be able to send and receive secure, virus-free emails from my very own email server. That just about wraps it up for this month. Hope you enjoyed this little excursion into the technical side of running the genealogybytim.com website. By next month, I hope to have done a little more work on the DNA front, including uploading my results to gedmatch.com and maybe reaching out to one or two of my closest matches. Until then, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits. Bye now.